Morning, everyone. It's my pleasure to welcome our speaker this morning, but before we get started, I wanted to remind everybody again about the Internal Medicine Conference, March 23rd, 24th, and 25th. It's the afternoon of the 23rd, the morning of the 24th, and the morning of the 25th. You can register, and you can come to as many of the lectures each of those days as you want, as many or as few as you want to, but we highly recommend that everybody attend. It's over at the Marriott over near Town Center Mall on Military Trail. Again, this morning I'm going to introduce Dr. Sachin Sul, who is an associate professor of integrated medical science. He's the director of the Internal Medicine Residency Program for FAU at the Charles E. Schmidt College of Medicine. Dr. Sul went to medical school in Mumbai, India, where he's from. He then did his internship and residency at the New York Medical College in Westchester. Previously, he was the administrative chief medical resident there also. And it is my pleasure to welcome him. He's going to give us a talk this morning on syncope, which hopefully won't happen to anybody right now.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. It's match week, as everybody knows, and so we are all excited this week, and we'll come to know on Friday who we are getting, the new interns coming in July. So this week is really exciting for the medical school and the residency program. So today I'm going to talk about a common problem that we see frequently, either in practice or in the emergency room, that's syncope. So to begin with, I have no financial disclosures relevant to the talk. So the learning objectives today, what we're going to do is define syncope and classify the types, talk about risk assessment, which is important, and evaluation, and then discuss management of common causes of syncope that we normally encounter. It's defined as a transient loss of consciousness, which is important, the word transient, attributable to global cerebral hypoperfusion, and it's rapid in onset. There's brevity, which is shortness of time, and spontaneous recovery. So I think when we talk about syncope, it's important to recognize some of these aspects, especially spontaneous recovery, when we see patients and talk to them and they complain of loss of consciousness. So let's talk about the burden. So if you look at the events and visits per 1,000 patient years, if you look at the events in the general population, about 19 to 40 per 1,000 patient years if you are in general practice, because not all of them would go to the physician, so you have about 9 or so, and then even less would go to the ED. Not an insignificant number if you look at the general population. Kind of represents the age of first syncope or faint. And if you see on the left, you can see a big spike up in the second decade. So that tells us that the age of the first faint is usually more commonly early on, in the second or maybe third decade. And then it kind of goes down, and for some reason it's lowest at the age around 50 and then goes up. But if you look at the cumulative age, it's going to go up with as you get older. But certainly the spike initially is early on. And that can be explained based on the most common type of syncope. So So just about the background, 1 to 2 million patients annually with almost a similar incidence in women and men, about 1% of emergency medicine encounters. But look at the number of admissions, 30 to 40% subsequent admissions, and the costs about $2 to $3 billion annually. Now it's associated with significant morbidity and impacting the quality of life because it creates a lot of anxiety and it disrupts your normal activities. And the prognosis depends. It's relatively benign for the most common cause, the vasovagal one, and then it could be poor depending upon structural heart disease and ventricular arrhythmias and so forth. The other thing to know, the older you get, the more likely you're admitted to the hospital. More than half of patients above the age of 80 who come to the emergency room or at home with syncope are admitted. There's a higher prevalence in older institutionalized patients, 23%, and a pretty high recurrence rate of about 30%. And there is a high fall rate as well, 1 year fall rate when syncope occurs in older adults, about 38%. So it's adds on to the morbidity if you look at the entire picture. Now, talking about the types of syncope, so the most common is reflex. NMS is neurally mediated syncope. VVS is vasovagal. CSS is carotid sinus syndrome. And then you have the situational ones, cough syncope, post-micturition syncope. And they are certainly the most common. 60% of patients belong to this category, so certainly a big chunk of patients have the reflex mediated. Then the next one is orthostatic, so that's either drug-induced, volume depletion, we see that commonly. ANS is autonomic system failure, whether it's primary or secondary, so that's about 15%. And then the more serious ones, cardiac arrhythmias and structural cardiovascular, together they account for about 15%. And within the arrhythmias, you could have the bradycardias, the tachycardias, and the less common long QT syndrome or Brugada and so forth. Structural aortic stenosis is always thought of when someone comes with syncope. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, young athletes. PE can present pulmonary hypertension. But there's about 10% where we cannot find an etiology, and we see that as well. But still to remember, by far the most common is reflex mediated, and vasovagal is still the most common cause of syncope, and that explains the spike that you see early on. In the incidence of the first age of first faint. So this kind of tells us about what happens in vasovagal. Most of you know it. It's decrease in venous return. Then there's reduced ventricular filling that leads to increased sympathetic tone, hypercontractility. Then you have ventricular mechanoreceptor activation, and then you get a feedback via the afferent vagus. There's withdrawal of the sympathetic stimulus, parasympathetic overdrive, bradycardia, hypertension, and syncope. So this is the most common vasovagal pathophysiology, and this is important because some of the therapeutic options were block some of the pathway. So let's talk about the initial evaluation. So the three questions to be answered: is it syncope? Because that's very common dilemma. Is it syncope or no? is there a clear etiology? And are there any high-risk features? And the reason for risk assessment is really very, very important, either to decide hospitalization, how aggressive you want to be, or whether it's outpatient management. So these are the three basic questions you're going to think of when you see a patient with syncope. Hopefully you can see this, but just remember you can differentiate syncope and non-syncopal events based on history. So vasovagal, the most common, it's provoked by prolonged standing in a hot, crowded environment associated with any procedure or pain. It can occur at rest or after exercise. There's a prodrome usually with vasovagal, and it's brief, less than 5 minutes. And then after that, the patients might feel fatigued and so forth. Compare it to cardiac, it can happen at rest or exertion. Brief or absent prodrome, important. Rapid recovery, again, it's brief, but there's rapid recovery, and maybe preceded by palpitations. And then you can have seizures, tongue bite, and we try to differentiate between syncope and seizures. And then pseudosyncope. Occasionally, we might see a patient with pseudosyncope. And usually, they complain of prolonged loss of consciousness. So that sometimes helps us. They'll say they lost consciousness for 15 minutes, 20 minutes. But remember, syncope is the shortness of time and rapid recovery. Lack of injury in spite of frequent episodes or a known psychiatric disorder. So it's possible to differentiate between syncope and non-syncopal events just on history. So I'm just going to take a little bit of time talking about an aspect which is important in all whatever you talk about in medicine, because it's going to come up in subsequent slides. This is from ACC, published in Circulation. So whenever we talk about evaluation or management, it's really based on two things. One is class of recommendation and the level of evidence. And as you can see, class 1 to class 3, the benefit decreases. They're based on the recommendation. So class 1 is a strong recommendation, and it starts getting weaker as you go down, class 2A, 2B, till you actually reach class 3, which is, and the bottom of it is harm. So if you remember, everything is based on evidence, evidence-based medicine. So class of recommendation, and then you have the level of evidence to back it up. And again, level A is the strongest level. Either you have a randomized controlled trial, multiple. Then you go to level B, which is again based on randomized trials, but not as strong. Then you have level B, non-randomized. Level C, limited data. And the last is level C, EO is expert opinion. So there are certain things you still do in medicine based upon experience and expert opinion. So that's important to remember as well. When you talk about experience and expert opinion, there is something called as evidence based on expert opinion. So it's important to remember this, because it's going to come up in subsequent slides when I talk about investigation. I'll talk about what backs it up and what's the class of recommendation. So history and physical exam, when you see a patient with syncope, it's a class 1 recommendation. So a detailed history and physical exam should be performed in patients with syncope. Is it based on a randomized trial? No. They didn't do randomized trials where you have where you take history in one patient and don't take history in another patient. But it's a class one recommendation. In the initial evaluation of patients with syncope, arresting 12-lead ECG or EKG is useful. Class one recommendation, but non-randomized. They didn't do a randomized trial, but it's still class one. So the one thing to remember is the class of recommendation and the level of evidence are independent of each other. You could have any class of recommendation with any level of evidence. It depends on the prevalence of the disease and so forth. So that's class one recommendation. So you should take the history and do an EKG. The history will help you differentiate cardiac versus non-cardiac. We spoke about that in the previous slide, and some of it is back here. So more often with cardiac causes, older age, males, presence of a known ischemic heart disease, syncope during exertion, syncope in supine position, more common with cardiac, family history of an inheritable condition, so forth. More common with non-cardiac, younger age, vasovagal, or no known cardiac disease, prodrome, we spoke about that before, only in the standing position. So if that's more likely to be non-cardiac, because cardiac can occur both supine and standing. So history can help you differentiate between cardiac and non-cardiac. The physical exam should focus on four things. So you want to look at the heart rate, look for orthostatic hypotension, auscultate, look for any, see if you can hear any murmurs, do a neurological exam, and look for any deficits. So orthostatic hypotension, just for the students and residents, blood pressure in the supine, sitting and erect position. If there is a fall, a symptomatic fall from baseline of greater than or equal to 20 in systolic and 10 in diastolic, or a decrease to less than 90 systolic blood pressure within 3 minutes of standing, when compared to blood pressure from the sitting or supine position. So symptomatic fall. So that's another thing to remember, because it might not be done accurately and you might falsely label somebody as orthostatic or miss some of the patients who have orthostatic hypotension. So general principles, this is from the ACC and AHA. So when you have a patient with transient loss of consciousness, you suspect the patient has syncope. If you don't, then you do other things. If you suspect, we spoke about class one, do the history, physical exam, EKG. If the cause of syncope is certain, you treat it. If it's uncertain, you do further evaluation. But again, in both, do a risk assessment, and I'll tell you why, because the risk assessment is extremely important. So, class one recommendation, again, not based on a non-randomized trial. Evaluation and assessment for short-term and long-term morbidity and mortality risk are recommended. And use of risk stratification scores may be reasonable in the management of patients with syncope. That's a 2B recommendation based on a non-randomized study, so slightly weaker. And you do that, the risk assessment, as I said, is to decide whether you want to keep the patient in the hospital, discharge them, and how aggressive you want to be with their initial evaluation. So some of the syncope risk scores that are available, and you can use for risk stratification, the San Francisco rule. So you look at the EKG, if they have CHF or shortness of breath, or they have a low hematocrit, or the systolic blood pressure is less than 90. So risk is, if they have any one of these, they have a risk for a serious event at 7 days. So that's short-term morbidity, 98% sensitive and 56% specific. So look for this, see if they have any risk, and then that can tell you if they are at risk for serious events at 7 days. There are a lot of these risk scores. Another one which is more popular is the third, the OSIL score, and it tells you long-term morbidity. So they looked at mortality at 1 year, and they have a point system based on EKG, history of cardiovascular disease, lack of a prodrome, and the age. And as you see, if you get more points, the one-year mortality increases till you reach 53% with a score of 4. So that's a long-term morbidity and mortality. So you have the San Francisco rule that tells you short-term risk, and the OSIL score that tells you long-term risk. So it's good to know what their risk is when you're evaluating these patients, and that will help you decide how aggressive or you want to put them in the hospital or discharge them. So this is another, everybody has the handouts, you can just do the score here. So you want to put them into high risk, intermediate risk, and low risk categories. Low risk, younger patients with no prior history, normal EKG, normal cardiovascular exam, that's low risk. Then you have the high risk with chest pain, suggestive of acute coronary syndrome, signs of CHF, valvular heart disease, history of arrhythmias, and so forth. Look at this, they have persistent sinus brady, that's in the absence of any medications that can reduce the heart rate. So that's a high risk group as well, and anything in between is the intermediate risk group. So keep that in mind when you evaluate patients. So short-term high-risk criteria which require prompt hospitalization or intensive evaluation. Important to remember, that will help you decide how aggressive. So if they have severe structural or coronary artery disease, such as heart failure, low EF, or previous MI, and clinical or EKG features suggestive of arrhythmic syncope, that's high risk. You have within the EKG findings, you could have a bifascicular block or a excited QRS complex, prolonged or short QT, Brugada pattern, and so forth. And along with that, if they have severe comorbidities like anemia and electrolyte imbalance, again adds to the high risk features. So these might require the patient to be placed in the hospital. So mnemonics, everybody likes mnemonics. So this was published a few years back in JACC. Makes it easier. So the Rose rule, that's the risk stratification of syncope in the ED. Admit if any of the following are present. BNP, braces is the mnemonic, easy to remember. BNP greater than 300, bradycardia less than 50, rectal exam showing fecal-occult blood, anemia less than 9, chest pain associated with syncope, EKG showing a Q wave, not in lead 3, saturation less than 94%. If any of these are present, you should consider the patient as high risk. And have an inpatient evaluation. So it makes it easier so you can remember the Rose rule for syncope. When you see patients in the ED, think about braces. So this was something which we did. So I was the first author for this, and we published it in the Journal of Clinical Cardiology. We looked at etiology of syncope in patients hospitalized with syncope and tried to look at predictors of mortality and rehospitalization. 325 patients, 27-month follow-up. So we looked at independent prognostic factors for rehospitalization, and diabetes, AFib, smoking were significant independent prognostic factors for rehospitalization. And then the significant independent prognostic factors from time to mortality, again, were diabetes, history of bypass, coronary artery bypass, history of malignancy, narcotics use, smoking, AFib, and volume depletion. So this was what we studied, single center, at my previous institution. So that kind of tells us what the high-risk features are. So diabetic patients, we know high risk of rehospitalization and increased mortality. This is again from the ACC-AHA. So what do you do with patients after the initial evaluation? So if there are serious medical conditions, which we spoke about, inpatient evaluation, that's a class one recommendation. If there are no serious medical conditions, you can maybe manage a presumptive reflex-mediated syncope in an outpatient setting. You could have a structured ED protocol, that's observation. We do that for intermediate-risk patients, class 2A recommendation. And you can manage selected patients with suspected syncope in an outpatient setting, that's class 2B. So if there are serious conditions, it's very clear that you will admit them. Intermediate risk, we do observation, which is true. We do that for our patients. And then you have the other two categories for outpatient management. So this is the same thing that talks about that the only difference, it gives you the level of evidence as well, you know, in addition to the class of recommendation. So you can see that the level of evidence, there is no level of evidence, there is no level A evidence. It's all level B or C. Though you have a class of recommendation, which is class one, but there's no level A evidence. So additional evaluation, now you may have the patient in the hospital, but what do you do? So, because a lot of times the initial evaluation may be unclear. If it's clear, you don't have to do anything, but a lot of times it's not so clear. So you have to go on the history, examine what your clinical judgment is, and you have this algorithm. So you can have some targeted blood tests based on your clinical judgment. You can have referral for autonomic evaluation if you suspect neurogenic orthostatic hypotension. Tilt table if the initial evaluation suggests reflex syncope. If the initial evaluation suggests cardiovascular abnormalities, you have a cardiac monitor, that's a class one indication. It can be an implantable monitor or an ambulatory monitor. And then you have other options based on your clinical evaluation, whether it's stress test, echo, EP, MRI, or CT. So the only class one recommendation here is a cardiac monitor based on frequency and nature. Rest are all class 2A or 2B. So again, the same thing, but tells you the level of evidence to back it up. No level A evidence here. So targeted blood tests are reasonable. Usefulness of BNP and high sensitivity troponin is uncertain in patients for whom a cardiac cause of syncope is suspected. And routine and comprehensive lab testing is not useful in the evaluation of patients with syncope. So class of recommendation 3, no benefit, based on the level of evidence, which is level BR, which is randomized. So routine and comprehensive lab testing is not useful in the evaluation of patients with syncope. Do we do it? We do. But that's the class of recommendation, and that's there is no benefit. Cardiac imaging. Echo can be useful in selected patients presenting with syncope if structural heart disease is suspected, 2A. CT or MRI may be useful in selected patients presenting with syncope of suspected cardiac etiology. Now, no benefit for routine cardiac imaging is not useful in the evaluation of patients with syncope unless cardiac etiology is suspected on the basis of an initial evaluation, including history, physical, or EKG. So that's no benefit unless you suspect a cardiac etiology. So routine imaging, like an echo for every patient with syncope, has no benefit. Another thing to remember. Stress testing, class 2A recommendation based on limited data. Exercise stress testing can be useful to establish the cause of syncope in selected patients who experience syncope or pre-syncope during exertion, based on limited data, not a randomized. So level C evidence, class 2A recommendation. Cardiac monitoring. So the choice of a specific cardiac monitor should be determined on the basis of the frequency and nature of syncopal events. Class 1 recommendation, but based on expert opinion. So it's the level of evidence is based on expert opinion, but it's still a class 1 recommendation. And there are various monitors that are useful. Holter, trans-telephonic, external loop recorder, patch recorder, or you can have outpatient telemetry. So when you want to evaluate in the ambulatory setting, you can have a choice of monitors, class 2A recommendation. And to evaluate selected ambulatory patients with syncope of suspected arrhythmic etiology, and ICM is implantable cardiac monitor can be useful. Class 2A recommendation. So this tells you where you might think of putting an implantable loop recorder. So you're not going to use it. Sorry. So you are not going to use it here. If someone has low risk and a single syncope, you're not going to use a loop recorder. High risk, yes. You can think of having a loop recorder. Low risk but recurrent syncopal episodes, yes, there is a role for implantable loop recorder, and you still do other tests as appropriate, but you can have the loop recorder. And the loop recorder sometimes can be used even when you suspect non-syncopal etiologies while you are waiting for other tests. But you don't want to use it in a low-risk patient with single or rare syncope. So in-hospital telemetry, when you admit a patient, continuous EKG monitoring is useful for hospitalized patients admitted for syncopal evaluation with suspected cardiac etiology. So if they have high-risk features, class one recommendation would be to admit and do evaluation, and you use in-hospital telemetry. So that's a class one recommendation. EP. So EPS can be useful for evaluation of selected patients with syncope of suspected arrhythmic etiology. So there is a role, class 2A. It's not recommended for syncope evaluation in patients with a normal EKG, normal cardiac structure and function, unless an arrhythmic etiology is suspected. So no benefit if you don't have an abnormal EKG and or you suspect an arrhythmic etiology. So tilt table testing. So if the diagnosis is unclear after initial evaluation, tilt table testing can be useful for patients with suspected VVS, that's vasovagal syncope, class 2A. Tilt table testing can also be useful for patients with syncope and suspected delayed orthostatic hypotension when initial evaluation is not diagnostic. It's reasonable to distinguish tilt table testing from convulsive syncope from epilepsy, class 2A. Reasonable to do tilt table to establish a diagnosis of pseudosyncope. It's not recommended, no benefit, to predict a response to medical treatment for vasovagal syncope. So it's only in diagnosis, but not as something you do to follow up patients. So remember that. So when do you not do tilt table testing? Relatively contraindicated syncope with clinically severe left ventricular outflow obstruction, mitral stenosis, coronary artery stenosis critical, or cerebrovascular stenosis. So when you think of tilt table, you have to make sure you're not putting the patient, causing more harm. And you really got to exclude some of these before you have them do tilt table. So autonomic evaluation. So referral for autonomic evaluation can be useful to improve diagnostic and prognostic accuracy in selected patients with syncope and known or suspected neurodegenerative disease. It's based on limited data. It's a class 2A recommendation. So if you suspect patients or have, you could refer them for further testing. So again, if you look at this, you can do, so the key thing here just to remember is that there's no benefit for routine MRI and CT. No benefit for routine carotid artery imaging, like carotid ultrasound. No benefit of routine recording of an EEG. No benefit in the absence of features suggestive of a seizure. So that's the key thing to remember here. There's no benefit with all these tests unless there is something else clinically to support ordering these tests. So please do not order routine carotid ultrasounds, MRI, CT, EEG in all patients who come with syncope. So moving on to some of the management, and this is based on the 2017 ACC-AHA, American College of Cardiology, American Heart, and Heart Rhythm Society guideline for the evaluation and management of patients with syncope. So first, let's talk about the most common ones, which are the reflex conditions. So vasovagal syncope, Class 1 recommendation, patient education on the diagnosis and prognosis is recommended. That's the only Class 1 recommendation. The rest are Class 2A and 2B. Physical counter-pressure maneuvers, and I'll come to that in the next slide, can be useful in patients with vasovagal syncope who have a sufficiently long prodromal period. And these are some of those physical counter-pressure maneuvers. So you are essentially trying to prevent the gravitational pooling of blood and what happens in the initial phase of vasovagal syncope. So there are, you know, these are common maneuvers. Leg crossing is another one. So it's not just leg crossing. It's leg crossing with intentional contraction of your leg muscles, abdominal muscles, and that's the way you're going to have a counter pressure. So these are the three, and this is useful if a patient who has had vasovagal has a, you know, a substantial prodromal period. They can actually recognize that they're going to have an episode and do some of these maneuvers to prevent that. And they are all easy. You don't need anything. So think about that and educate the patients about physical counter-pressure maneuvers. Midodrine, reasonable in patients with recurrent vasovagal with no history of hypertension, heart failure, or urinary retention. Class 2A recommendation based on a randomized trial, which is level B evidence. The usefulness of orthostatic training is uncertain in patients with frequent vasovagal. And then you have fludrocortisone might be reasonable for patients with recurrent vasovagal and inadequate response to salt and fluid intake. Class 2B based on a randomized trial. Level of evidence is B, R is randomized. So we spoke about that. What about beta blockers? Class 2B recommendation, but not based on randomized trial, might be reasonable in patients 42 years of age or older with recurrent vasovagal. And the next three are based on limited data, but still class 2B, encouraging increased salt and fluid intake may be reasonable, unless contraindicated. It may be reasonable to reduce or withdraw medications that cause hypotension when appropriate. And in patients with recurrent vasovagal, SSRI might be considered based on limited data, class 2B recommendation. So this is the algorithm based on ACC-AHA. So you can follow, easy to follow, try counter pressure maneuvers, recommend and educate, salt and fluid. If it still recurs, you have all these options. Look at that, class 2A is midodrine, so you want to try that. Rest are class 2B recommendations. We're going to come to this, dual chamber pacing. So dual chamber pacing might be reasonable in a select population of patients 40 years of age or older with recurrent vasovagal and prolonged spontaneous pauses. Class 2B recommendation based on system level of evidence is B, based on a systematic review of a randomized trial. So, but of course, you're not going to pay, you're going to try the other maneuvers first. So the basic things, common things you do first, and then you have a lot of options based on the age and other factors. So there's treatment for vasovagal syncope, APAR. So that's one of the things I want to stress upon. And that's quite a few options here when you It's not just increased salt and fluid and so forth. So a little bit on carotid sinus syndrome. Permanent cardiac pacing is reasonable in patients with carotid sinus syndrome that is cardioinhibitory or mixed, class 2A, based on a randomized trial. It may be reasonable to implant a dual chamber pacemaker in patients with carotid sinus syndrome who require permanent pacing. So this is something you got to be really careful with if you attempt. In patients who have carotid sinus hypersensitivity or suspected carotid sinus syndrome. So carotid sinus massage over the point of maximal carotid impulse for 5 to 10 seconds on each carotid sinus with a 1 minute interval between massages. You got to monitor EKG and blood pressure. Don't do it without EKG and blood pressure monitoring. Positive result is if any of the following three are met. Asystole, that's scary, so you got to be exceeding 3 seconds, cardioinhibitory. Reduction in systolic blood pressure exceeding 50 millimeters independent of heart rate, that's vasodepressor, and combination of the above. But if you go back, so cardiac pacing is for cardioinhibitory or mixed. So I wouldn't recommend that. I wouldn't recommend that you try that on your own because, as you see, it's something that you want to really think about before you try. But this is something I wanted to tell you. The concept of carotid sinus syndrome or hypersensitivity, we'll come to that. Is important when you decide if the patient can drive or no. But that's one of the slides later on. So talking about orthostatic hypotension based on the 2017 ACC-AHA-HRS guideline. So neurogenic orthostatic hypotension is first. Then we'll talk about others. So acute water ingestion is recommended in patients with syncope caused by neurogenic orthostatic hypotension for occasional temporary relief. So class 1 recommendation based on a randomized trial, level B evidence. Now you have a role of physical counterpressure maneuvers in patients with neurogenic orthostatic hypotension with syncope, but that's based on limited data, class 2A. Compression garments can be beneficial with patients with syncope and orthostatic hypotension. Midodrine, again, can be beneficial based on a randomized trial, 2A. Troxidopa, which is a precursor of norepinephrine, can be beneficial in patients with syncope due to neurogenic orthostatic hypotension, class 2A. You have somewhat similar fludrocortisone, encouraging salt and fluid intake, class 2B. Pyridostigmin may be beneficial in patients with syncope due to neurogenic orthostatic hypotension who are refractory to other treatments based on limited data. Octreotide may be beneficial in patients with syncope and refractory recurrent postprandial or neurogenic hypotension. So dehydration is easy. Class 1 recommendation is fluid resuscitation. Based on limited data, can you imagine? The level of evidence is not level A. It's based on limited data that fluid resuscitation is helpful in dehydration is not a level A evidence, but a class 1 recommendation. Reduce or withdraw medications that may cause hypertension and increase salt and fluid intake. So those are all pretty reasonable options. So this is the algorithm that helps makes it easier to understand. So suspected orthostatic hypotension proven by blood pressure drop. You divide it into either it's neurogenic, drugs, dehydration, neurogenic, or acute water ingestion, and then you have a whole bunch of options for the neurogenic orthostatic hypotension. The drugs, reduce or withdraw, dehydration, reduce or withdraw medications, and increase salt and fluid intake. Some of these are similar to what you had in vasovagal. You had midodrine, you had fludrocortisone, counter pressure manures, and so forth. So the algorithm is much easier to understand. So I'm not going to spend too much time on management of cardiovascular conditions because they're all determined by the guidelines and each has its own algorithm. And it's GDMD is guideline-directed management, so each is a topic of its own, so really cannot, it's beyond the scope of management for each of these is a separate talk of its own. But you probably will never see this arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy as a cause of syncope. Something to think about. ICD implantation is recommended. Cardiac sarcoidosis as a cause of syncope. Unusual, but can happen. And ICD implantation is recommended in patients with cardiac sarcoidosis presented with syncope and documented sustained ventricular arrhythmia. Again, it's more specialized. Brugada ICD implantation is reasonable, class 2A recommendation. I don't want to focus too much on it. Short QT syndrome, ICD implantation in patients with short QT pattern and suspected arrhythmic etiology. Long QT syndrome, LCSD is left cardiac sympathetic denervation. But these are more of specialized treatment options beyond the scope of our talk here. But just to have some idea about what is available and what are some of the causes that you might encounter. Early repolarization is something that we see on EKG. Is it always benign? Patients can, ICD implantation may be considered in patients with early repolarization pattern and suspected arrhythmic syncope in the presence of a family history of early repolarization with cardiac arrest. So something to think about. We see patients and we say they have early repolarization, but this is based on expert opinion, not based on any trials. EPS should not be performed in patients with early repolarization pattern and history of syncope in the absence of other indications. So that's harm, so don't refer for EP. Again, more specialized adult congenital heart disease. But this is, pseudosyncope is something that we might encounter and have to differentiate from syncope. So in patients with suspected pseudosyncope, a candid discussion with the patient is reasonable. Cognitive behavioral therapy may be beneficial in patients with pseudosyncope, so think about that. Class 2B recommendation based on limited data. But think about CBT in patients with pseudosyncope. Now there are certain recommendations based on age, lifestyle, and certain special populations. So for the assessment and management of older adults with syncope, class 2A recommendation, you work with a geriatric expert, can be beneficial. And it is reasonable to consider syncope as a cause of non-accidental falls in older adults. So, and this is very true. We see that with patients who get admitted to the hospital, but consider syncope as a cause of non-accidental falls. So this was another study that we did and published. I wasn't the first author, but so we looked at older patients in this study, 352, reasonable number, 65 and older, and the significant independent prognostic factors for mortality, again, diabetes, history of smoking, and inverse relationship to statins. And independent risk factors for predicting a cardiac cause of syncope were an abnormal EKG and reduced ejection fraction. So this was, we published in 2013. So athletes, let's look at athletes. So cardiovascular assessment by a care provider experienced in treating athletes with syncope is recommended prior to resuming competitive sports, class 1 recommendation, but based on expert opinion. Assessment by a specialist with disease-specific expertise is reasonable for athletes with syncope and high-risk markers. Extended monitoring can be beneficial for athletes with unexplained exertional syncope after an initial cardiovascular evaluation. So this is ideal situation for an implantable monitor. But participation in competitive sports is not recommended for athletes with syncope and phenotype positive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. CPVT is the catecholamine polymorphic ventricular tachycardia, long QT syndrome, or arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy before evaluation by a specialist. So that can lead to harm. So one of the things to think about when we see patients in the clinic. So driving and syncope. So it can be beneficial for healthcare providers managing patients with syncope to know the driving laws and restrictions in their regions and discuss implications with their patient. Class 2A recommendation based on expert opinion. So what I'm going to do is just, I don't know whether you can see, so syncope and driving recommendations. So the symptom-free waiting time, so what I've tried to do is highlight those who are not fit to drive. So vasovagal syncope with more than 6 syncopal episodes per year, not fit to drive until symptoms are resolved. Untreated cough syncope, not fit to drive. Carotid sinus syncope, untreated, not fit to drive. Untreated syncope due to non-reflex bradycardia, not fit to drive. Untreated SVT, not fit. Syncope with LVEF less than 35% and a presumed arrhythmic etiology without an ICD, not fit to drive. Not fit to drive if you have syncope presumed due to VT or VF, structural heart disease, and LVEF greater than 35% untreated. VT with a genetic cause untreated, not fit to drive, and syncope presumed due to non-structural heart disease, not fit to drive. And the last one is if you cannot determine the etiology of syncope, wait for a month. Ask them to wait for a month before you allow them to drive. So it's kind of important to know what the driving recommendations are before they land up in an accident. So I just wanted to end with, so it's not an uncommon event. It's important to classify syncope and recognize high-risk features. And if you do, you have appropriate diagnostic and therapeutic tools. And it's possible to prevent recurrence if we do the appropriate diagnostic workup and use the appropriate therapeutic tools. So I'm going to end with that. Thank you very much. Dr. Hare.
Can I just add, for the residents' benefit, sometimes they fix certain things like not a CT scan, and you alluded to it, unless there's unusual circumstances. But an older person who hits their head.
Yes. Yes, yes. Yeah, so the recommendation is unless you suspect another clinical indication, like someone hitting their head or they are on some other medicines, a routine MRI or CT for a low-risk patient is not indicated. But if they fall and hit their head, yes. That is a relevant clinical indication. Other questions? All right. Thank you.